Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. It happened, and we choked on words. Before we had decided to call it 9/11, before we knew the real death toll, when it was all smoke and fire, yet we had to speak. Silence is not an option in the human search for meaning. But listen to the words of the first 36 hours after the attacks. You hear both the limits of language and the beginnings of a new 9/11 lexicon.
Who can understand it? Who can explain it to yourself, much less your children? But we have asked Dr. Cohen to come in.
Mayor, you were one of the first people down there. Can you describe the scene in your own words, what you saw down there?
I don't know that I'm really able to describe it. It was the most horrific scene I've ever seen in my whole life.
We're trying to get in the voids. We're crawling through holes. We have dogs out there, people with cameras. It's a horrendous. It's an act of pure evil.
And then she went to get me. I ran to the phone. Mark said, "Mom, this is Mark Bingham." He gave me his last name. He was so rattled.
Our grief has turned to anger, and anger to resolution. Whether we bring our enemies to justice or bring justice to our enemies, justice will be done.
The people I've talked to say that President Bush has been impressive and that whatever he now orders, they will back. They clearly expect some kind of retaliation. The word vengeance is on people's lips.
American people have a clear understanding that this is a war. It's the way they see it. You can't see it any other way, whether legally that is correct or not. And we've got to respond.
I mean, all in all, it's the type of thing that you say to yourself, oh, no, when it gets daylight later, this is all just a bad dream.
For a while, after what we now call 9/11, we were all linguistic explorers. The Connection spent an hour last September discussing what we called the language void, our struggle to find words for what was happening. And since then, language has adapted, changed, new words and phrases, old phrases given new meanings, some elevated to mythic status. Connection listeners, we're asking you to reflect on the power of language since September 11th. For example, what makes up your 9/11 lexicon? Has language proved to be the key or a hindrance to understanding? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. My guests today are Sandy Silberstein. She's an applied linguist at the University of Washington in Seattle and author of the new book, War of Words, Language, Politics, and 9/11. And with me in the studio, Jay Kaiser, professor emeritus of linguistics at MIT. Jay was also with us on the program that we did last September, so we'll be able to look back then and where we are right now. I want to start, if I can, Sandy, with you, because just listening to that collection of words that was strung together of the hours after the attacks on the World Trade Center towers in Washington, the crash in Pennsylvania, I'm hearing both the political words, the national language, and then those encounters on the street as people all spoke about or tried to find the words to describe what they'd seen. In your book, you specifically pick apart one such encounter between a CNN reporter and an eyewitnesses as what? As a way of understanding how language is used or misused?
Well, I guess from my perspective, language reflects our world and it also creates it. And it's important to me to really think about how it is that the media mediates our experiences. So on the one hand, I describe a woman who's seen truly awful things and is sharing that experience in a way that can only be extraordinarily moving for anyone who heard that. At the same time, that language and that entire experience gets mediated so that, for example, her story simply becomes a voiceover for the images that the media chooses to show us. And there is language, written language, that's above her and below her. Sometimes she's in a little box, and we're being told this is the attack on America. So in that sense, language is reflecting a world, but it's also being used to create a kind of national experience.
Jay, do you remember last year we wound up talking about television and how important the images are in the language of that event, that the pictures are in effect part of the language. When you reflect back on how people used words to make sense of that and where we are with that right now, are you finding that it's any clearer?
Well, I remember I saw a study reported in the Globe, which I found very interesting. The study was designed to see the relationship between two factors, which I'll come to, and the probability that an individual would suffer a stress disorder because of 9/11. And it was very interesting because it turns out that the closer you live to New York City, the greater the possibility that you suffer a stress disorder. So that people in Los Angeles were less apt to than people who were in New Jersey. The other thing was, it was also proportional to how much television time you spent watching. So the more television you watch, the greater the possibility that you'd suffer stress disorder. Now, TV is a visual image, a visual medium. And so it's the visions that I think were perpetrated over and over and over again, which were actually had an impact. I feel, frankly, that a picture is worth a thousand words. Doris Lessing, in her book, The Prisons We Choose to Live Inside, argues, I think, eloquently for the power of the spoken word. And, of course, that's what Sandra's book is about. Mm-hmm. When you think of 9/11, what do you think? Do you think 9/11? No. You see a plane going into the side of a building. And that's why, for example, the best poetry is the poetry that leaves you with an image.
Sandy, what do you think? Does applied linguistics leave space for an interpretation of the images as an understanding of the language?
Oh, of course. In a sense, we're talking about just a different kind of literacy, a visual literacy, and both those images and the language that was used around those images are a kind of language. But I think it's important to understand that those images didn't exist alone on television. They existed, as I say, with voiceovers, as well as these constant sort of moving tickers that told us how we were supposed to be processing that experience. And that experience was then described over and over again. For example, we weren't at war until the president's third and final address to the nation on that day. And until then, people weren't quite sure what to make of it. When the second plane hits, we know it's not an accident. It becomes an attack. People begin to talk about terror. And then it's a war. When we see those images today, we see them in the context of the language that was used to describe them.
You know, in the opening comments that you had, there was this one person who said, well, it's a war. I know it may not be a war legally, but it is a war. That I thought was sort of interesting because, you know, I've had a hard time thinking of this as a war because, to me, a war is an engagement between states. This was a horrendous criminal act by a group of thugs who were not part of a state. And I would have thought that it would be dealt with, you know, like a criminal act. And what I was struck by was how quickly it became a war.
Well, is it a war by the classic definition of the war? The way it's modified is a new war, a different kind of war. These are titles that are given to what's taken place over the past 11 months.
Well, I don't think it's a war in the classical notion of war, where states essentially engage in hostile activity. What I think is happening here is that there's a criminal gang out there, and that they has to be treated like a crime of tremendous magnitude, but it's a crime. You don't hear phrases like war on mafia, but it's sort of like a grotesque mafia. I mean, this is just a huge crime. But immediately it moved to war. Now, why? I mean, I think that's an interesting question to ask if I'm right. And the answer is because it's familiar. We know how to deal with wars, and this is something completely unfamiliar. So what we do is we make it familiar. Now, when we do that, we change reality, because now people are going to be tempted to think of it as a war and not a crime.
Changing the meaning by the choice of the word?
Exactly. And I think that's a danger.
Sandy?
Yeah, I agree, but I have a slightly different take on it. To my mind, it wasn't accidental that this became a war. That is to say that we had, as I said earlier, these series of locutions that ended with the president telling us that we were at war. I think that word confused us for several reasons. One is, as Jay said, that we think of states being at war. But the other is because, students learn in school that we have a declarations of war. We're used to certain procedures happening. In fact, in recent time, particularly after the War Powers Act, we haven't had declarations of war. What we've had is ratifications of presidential actions, and it's the job of the president to develop consensus around those actions. So what happens when the word war is used? Well, it's true that it's familiar in all of those things, but also certain things devolve. Particular powers go to the president as the commander-in-chief of the military. We now have war tribunals. There are issues around civil liberties that arise because the nation's told that it's in a state of war. So I don't see it as accidental that word was used by the administration and that a variety of things followed. Now, that wouldn't be possible if there weren't another kind of logic that's being drawn on. In other words, I'm not arguing that we're all simply dupes of this. Another campaign of words was to persuade the American people that consumerism was patriotism. And that really didn't go over very well.
There's so much else, though, when we look at the words. The one phrase that sticks in my head is homeland security.
Yeah.
You know, for years, other countries, mm-hmm. European countries, have had a minister of home affairs, very, very powerful secretary minister in that government. It never seemed important until homeland security became an issue.
I think, it's funny. My next-door neighbor rang the bell this morning. She knew I was going to be on the connection, and she rang the bell, and I answered, and she said, "I hate the word homeland." And then off she went. This shows, people really do care about words. I mean, and she took the trouble to come over and ring the bell and say, "I hate homeland." I guess she does because it's probably reminiscent of German Heimat, and she probably has kind of a redolence of that. But, there's something that I'd like to mention. I remember reading a Boston College study of Nightline during the Vietnam period. Nightline was supposed to be a national forum. And this study showed that the people who appeared on Nightline were, to a great extent, sort of apologists for the government position on Vietnam. And when the producer, Jeff Greenberg, was asked, why, for example, didn't you have somebody like Chomsky, who was against it, he said, well, he lacks concision. Chomsky lacks concision. And that's to be connected with the fact that we're not talking about arguments now. We're talking about words. In other words, we're talking about tiny little things that we can say in 5 seconds.
And we'll be back in just a few seconds with more on the language that we've experienced in the last year. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Degrees.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Language. Here's the president speaking in Atlanta, November 8th, 2001. This was a significant day in the making of the 9/11 lexicon, the elevation of the term "let's roll."
Courage and optimism led the passengers on Flight 93 to rush their murderers to save lives on the ground. Led by a young man whose last known words were the Lord's Prayer and "let's roll." He didn't know. He didn't know he had signed on for heroism when he boarded the plane that day.
Some of our greatest moments have been acts of courage for which no one could have ever prepared. We will always remember the words of that brave man expressing the spirit of a great country. We will never forget all we have lost and all we are fighting for. Ours is the cause of freedom. We've defeated freedom enemies before, and we will defeat them again. We cannot know every turn this battle will take, yet we know our cause is just and our ultimate victory is assured. We will no doubt face new challenges, but we have our marching orders. My fellow Americans, let's roll.
Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. That, of course, was President Bush speaking on the 8th of November of last year in Atlanta, Georgia, just a couple of months after 9/11, and in a way sets us up to talk a little bit, Sandy, about the way that words can be used to create myths, the myth-making power of words, the power of the media, the power of the president as well.
You know, I have to say something about Let's Roll. What was interesting about that was the way that then got taken up by advertisers, so that Saturn ads wanted to keep America rolling, and Chevy wanted to keep America rolling forward. All of these words that begin with from one trajectory get taken up in others.
But Jay, how cynical does this become? I'm thinking of a collection of words I saw in the Saturday New York Times, where the White House Chief of Staff Andrew Card was asked about the administration's policy on Iraq, and he said, "Well, in a marketing sense, you wouldn't put anything out before Labor Day. You roll out your new product after that." I mean, is that the attitude that we see in the way that the language is also used and manipulated?
Yeah, I think he said we wouldn't make this known in August. Because nobody's going to see a new marketing. You wouldn't market something in August, so let's wait until September. I really think that to come back to my point about concision, these are slogans. Let's roll, freedom's enemies, change in regime. These are slogans that hide arguments, and they make it very hard for us as a people to think about these things.
But they become rallying points at the same time.
They become rallying points, and then nobody can think about the arguments behind them. I mean, let's roll. I mean, I think Sandy is exactly right to want to talk about that, because where does that come from? That comes from one of the great American myths, which is the myth of the West. And it's the wagon train, you know, and you can just see John Wayne at the head of the wagon train saying, let's roll. And this notion in America, the single individual makes a difference. It's the message behind a wagon train. It's the message behind Shane. This is the myth that Let's Roll taps into. So the speechwriters know what they're doing. They're tapping into a reservoir of emotion about this stuff. But what's the argument? I mean, what are the issues here? What is at stake? What does it mean, let's roll? Does that mean, for example, we should all put on roller skates and roll around? Nobody says what it means, at least in speeches like that. Why? Because it's too complicated.
But, Sandy, everybody gets to interpret it their own way, right, and make use of it that way? Isn't that part of the magic of a myth word or a myth phrase like that?
Yeah, I think two things happen. On the one hand, these are vessels that people have a lot of space to fill in very different ways. On the other hand, what I think we're really talking about here is nation building. There's been a lot of writing about the notion of the imagined community of a nation. That's a Benedict Anderson phrase. He's an anthropologist. The sense that you know, I've not met everybody in America, but somehow we imagine that when we say someone's an American that we know something about them, that we have these shared cultural strains. Jay's calling them, you know, reservoirs of emotion. Those are raw materials that can be called upon to rebuild this sense of the nation. And that was certainly very much manipulated in the wake of the events of September 11, 2001, where what you saw was constantly calls to understand an us with some kind of shared notion that the faceless enemy, the evil doer, was against everything we stood for. But as Jay points out, we never really discussed very much what it is we stood for. People were able then, as you're saying, Dick, to fill that vessel with what they imagine it is that a we stands for.
Connection listeners, reflect with us on the language of the past year, words like ground zero, the pit, the caves of Tora Bora. What does that say to us? Mazari Sharif, for example, a word that became particularly well used in a small town in northern Afghanistan. Did it emphasize the other in the story that we're talking about? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. And we're going first to Greensboro, North Carolina. Melissa's on the line. Hi, Melissa.
Hi. I was just going to make a couple of comments.
Go ahead.
One is, I think it's very interesting that when we finally did choose a way to label the day, we didn't choose words. We chose numbers. If you go on the internet and people talk about it, they don't write, you know, N-I-N-E, etc. They put down 9/11.
What does that say to you, Melissa?
It says a couple of things. One, it's very easy to use for most of the world on our numeric system. It's 9/11. It's not a language. It doesn't have to be translated. It's 9/11. It's the date. Everybody on our calendar would understand, no matter what country they were in. And that's what it says to me on one level. Another thing is I'm a poet. I write. And I don't think there are words. There is no word. For that, for the sudden death of 3,000 people.
Well, Melissa, I guess what I would, I mean, you pardon me if I resort to being a linguist, but what's happened is that the syllables 9/11 have become a word. And the way you can say show that is, for example, you can pluralize it. You can say, how many 9/11s can we stand?
True.
Or that was a terrible 9/11, where you can or that was another 9/11. So what the language faculty does is internalizes these things. But I think you're right to point out that the form of the word is with numbers, 9/11, but it is in fact a word now, and it's been incorporated into our vocabulary. So, for example, we don't confuse it at all with 911.
Right.
Except that it borrows a lot from 911, Sandy, as our understanding of the classic distress call, doesn't it?
Yes, I think that, you know, your original show turned on what is it that we will settle on. And I think people did for a while call it 911 and settled on 911. I'd like to say a couple of things about the use of the date. One is I have to tease Melissa just a little bit because she said our number system, and ironically, of course, this is known as the Arabic number system.
I've
thought a good deal about both 9/11 and September 11, and I think Melissa's exactly right in the respect that this event was so awful and of such scope that simply saying the date captures it. So on the one hand, I think it's understandable that that's what eventually became fixed in the lexicon, at least for now. On the other hand, you know, I have a friend who tells a story. He was in Java, and a friend of his walked into his house and said, I'll never drive again on April 24th. And he said, why? It was then April 24th. And he said, because I've just totaled my car. And my friend said, well, it would help if you drove slower. And his friend responded, yes, but I always drive this way. And the accident only happened on April 24th. So there's a way in which...
is it shifting the blame?
What it does is it puts the emphasis on the coincidence and not the antecedents of events.
Melissa,
in other words,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
In other words, something terrible happened on September 11. And on the one hand, I like that locution because it captures it was a moment in history, and that's important. On the other hand, by not calling it the attack or anything else, but 9/11, what it does is it frees us from asking questions about what that event was.
Just a last point, Melissa, from you. I kind of resist 9/11. I don't much like it. I find it puts me in cliche space, although I end up using it. Does it work the same way with you?
It does, and it we were talking about, or you guys were talking about the words like the otherization of the other side.
Right, or demonization,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I thought that was interesting because right around then, President Bush started talking about the axis of evil. You know, as though you could draw a circle and say, within this circle, evil, bad, the bad people. We're going to go attack the bad people. And it's so general. And 9/11 does sort of the same thing. It just, the word means, I guess, the ultimate moment of evil for our country. And I do apologize for saying our number system. I know it's Arabic. That was just my goof.
Thanks for your call, Melissa.
Thank you.
To Chapel Hill, North Carolina. David's on the line. Hi, David.
Hi. Great discussion. Thanks for having me on. I find this discussion somewhat ironic because, as an example, with the previous caller, a poet versus a linguist arguing words over words, and nobody's talking about personal images. I mean, when we speak about the power of words, what are we talking about? We're talking about the kind of power that's vested in metaphor and the larger-than-life associations of the primary symbols and images that live within us. And words have the power to posit great questions, but everybody's providing answers. And I'm just wondering, who's asking us to sit and be quiet? Who is seeking silence? And not even our religious leaders have begged us not to speak. And I just find that very ironic. How else do we expect to learn without knowing ourselves first?
Isn't the moment of silence, David, that's been invoked a number of times over the past year, something that's precisely to your point, that when words...
No, I find that political posturing. I find that...
Well, I've heard some pretty powerful moments of silence over the past year.
I have no doubt that that is true for individuals and at moments true for the group. But having it be the primary means, just ironically, this is so ironic, and I guess part of my excitement is I wrote a poem late last night, and I just submitted it to NPR, and in it I have a line that says, "And let God catch its breath and stop beseeching. This need for meaning, this need for answers cannot happen unless we ourselves allow the fear and the horror and the responsibility to seep in."
Well, I really resonate to what you're saying. I think that if I were to have to put what America felt in one word, it would be vulnerability. For the first time, everybody was frightened. And that's what I hear in your voice, and that's what I hear in your comments. I also think that you're right to ask the question, what's at the bottom of it? Where did all of this come from? And I think that's a very good question. Why is it? Let's see, I'm what, 67 years old, and as far as I can tell, the world has always been at war throughout my entire life.
Yes.
And so I would like to know, where does that come from? Why is war such a natural state of humanity? And that's what I hear you struggling with. I think you should take your silence on your own, but I think it's very important that we do some talking.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Sandy, go ahead.
I guess I'm also struck by, I think part of what David's speaking to is the public use of language, And I would dare say that for many, many people, even in those moments of silence, they're thinking in words, but those words are much more their own and much more local. And the question is how to have both silence and thought and local and personal understandings without a sort of constant bombardment of what we're now, I think, on the show calling slogans.
But I don't have the words myself to describe here or even in private that feeling in the middle, that gut-struck sense that we had on the day. And I guess, David, if I'm a little bit in sync with you, it's not being too troubled that I don't have those words.
And I share that with you. I am not uncomfortable with my discomfort. And getting back to the guest's comment about how it is that we are not comfortable with our vulnerability, it seems to me that we have not been tutored, or life has lost its apprenticeship program. And we seek, you know, through CNN to cry our tears and to say our words and testimonials. But as I say in my poem, I need to make comment to my very being first.
Thanks for your call, David.
Thanks.
Connection listeners, this hour, a conversation about language. Has it served you in the past year as a means of talking about not only what happened on the 11th of September, but in describing your sense of where this country went in the weeks and months afterwards and the adequacy of the language to continue the conversation even today? Is it being formed? Are we trying to make decisions too quickly about some of these things which are still before the country? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. This hour, we're talking about the language, the words that became part of our common form of communication in the days and weeks and months after September 11th. With me on the program, Sandy Silberstein. She's the author of a book called War of Words, Language, Politics, and 9/11. Sandy's an applied linguist at the University of Washington at Seattle. Jay Kaiser's in the studio with me. Jay's a professor emeritus of linguistics at MIT and has in his hand a copy of a letter, which is not particularly current. But, Jay, you were saying that this letter may, in fact, have some connection to what David was saying just before we went from the break.
Yes, I think something like this is what he was maybe looking for. I remember in that book by Doris Lessing, which was actually a series of radio talks, she quoted Thomas Jefferson as saying that the tree of liberty needed to be watered with the blood of patriots every so often. And she said, watch out when men start talking about blood, because it's a dangerous thing. And I was mentioning this to a colleague at MIT, Roz Williams, and she sent me a letter, which I thought was quite remarkable. It was a letter that was written by Carl Jung in November 6, 1960, a nuclear engineer, a man who had been manufacturing missiles, nuclear-armed missiles, asked Jung if he would mind being part of a conference designed to talk about how to attain the impossible dream of world peace. And what Jung said was this. He said, "The very objects and methods which have led civilized man out of the jungle have now attained to an autonomy which terrifies man. all the more so as he sees no ways and means to cope with them. Since he knows that his ogres are man-made, he lives under the illusion that he could and should control them, and he does not understand why this is not so. He is like Goethe's sorcerer's apprentice, who, using his master's magic, vivified his broom and could not stop him anymore. And then he goes on to say, "We are still in the same old jungle, where the individual is still threatened by dangerous factors, by machines, methods, organizations even more dangerous than the wild animals. Something has not apparently changed at all. We have carried the old jungle with us, and this is what nobody seems to understand. The jungle is in us, in our unconscious, and we have succeeded in projecting it into the outside world, where now the Saurians are lustily playing about again in the form of cars, airplanes, and rockets." Now, if you imagine a spectrum from feeling to thinking, the American public has been at the feeling end for the last year. Everything is emotional. Even the talk of war is emotional. Even the business of let's roll, it's all emotional. At the thinking end would be, what are the causes, how did we get to this point, and is there anything that we can do to move beyond it? But what Jung is saying is that this kind of built-in emotional response is hardwired in us. And what we our immediate response to hostility is hostility. And hostility itself comes from our nature. So what he says is we really ought to understand ourselves far better than we do. But every time we attempt to make a look at ourselves to figure out, are we hardwired for violence? For example, Richard Wrangham argues in his book, I think he was on your show, The Demonic Male, we're hardwired for violence. And so when a situation like this comes up, immediately what we respond to is the violence in us. And what we have to learn how to do is we have to find out first, is that true? And if it is true, how do you sit on it? And how does it shape our reactions? And what I think is that all of these words that we've been talking about are just, those are buttons that people have learned to press in order to get the hardwired violence circuits to resonate.
It's exactly what Sandy writes about in War of Words, that sense of always playing to the feeling, not the thinking. Sandy?
Well, but I have a slightly different a different take. I have to tease here as well. I imagine that Doris Lessing might respond, "Be careful when men say they can't help it." I don't think it's necessarily the issue of being hardwired. I think that we have certainly a bellicose strain, both in terms of practicing, in terms of rhetoric, in the society. But there's also a very different kind of strain, which is the one that Jay is hoping that people can access. I don't think that one is feeling and one is thought. I think both can be both. And the question is, how does one or the other get accessed? I was really struck by the use of the term hero during the early days after September 11. Initially, I was really I really had a very critical view of the fact that the media seemed to say that every poor soul who was lost in the World Trade Center sitting at an office desk was a hero. And that struck me as, in a sense, part of the bellicose tradition, you know, that you know, and we'll all be heroes and we'll go out and do something about it. I didn't want people to be victims, certainly, but I was very taken by that use of that term. I came to have a different view of it because what happened was, almost to a person, when people talked about the loved ones lost, and Sting echoed something I'd heard many, many times in the concert for New York, when he said, "This song is dedicated to a man who I presume would have died as he lived helping other people." This sense that we also have a strain that a hero is someone who selflessly helps others. I think that we have within cultures and within ourselves possibilities for bellicosity and for peace and rationality. And the rhetoric, the public rhetoric, is always at and a guilty pleasure I had writing this book was I got to use all these war metaphors, these two rhetorics are always at war. And certainly the administration was, and I think Jay speaking to this, really, and again, a guilty pleasure, expropriating that very bellicose rhetoric.
The public conversation, the private conversation. What's your conversation? We're going to Pocatello, Idaho. Viola's waiting on the line. Hi, Viola.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
Your discussion is quite interesting, but there is something that has seldom been brought up. This is the word unity, and Sandy sort of touched on this when she said that using the words that we're using after 9/11 is sort of an imagining in America the shared notion of the sense of us. And
well there's no imagination about it, Viola. The politicians were saying you are with us or you are with the terrorists, right?
Right, right. But that leaves some people out, and I think that missing from all of this conversation, no one is soliciting the views of, say, African Americans, Latino Americans, or Native Americans. It's as though we've been left out of the conversation. And from my own perspective as a Native American, I see this call for unity as being part of that, what Sandy calls the bellicose tradition. And when you say you're either with us or against it, there's no midway point, so that what I have felt from this call of unity, it sounds to me like a call for silence. Don't bring up any issues that detract from the fact that we think of ourselves as innocent, perhaps a bit naive, and totally blameless. And it's rather frightening to hear the white America claim unity is also a call to many minorities to just be quiet.
And you don't think that the second half of the hyphenated phrase that of the list that you went through, the African American, the Native American, the Latino American, is a strong enough bonding group for a politician to make a claim to speak either on behalf of or to?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not, because our voices have not been on television or whatever. I watched a program on ABC with Peter Jennings, In Search of America, and he talked to all of these white people, and once in a while he would talk to a black minister who said something about the fact that everybody was ignoring their problems. And it's almost as though you dare not speak up because America is slapping itself on the back for its unity, and at the same time, It doesn't allow us to say, but wait a minute, and there are other views here, other voices that should be heard, other Americans. I heard a black woman say, well, she says, now they know what terrorism is like. We've lived with it all our lives.
Not a lot of room for dissent.
So I don't fear. I have no fear of 9/11 because it didn't strike where I am.
Right. You live in Pocatello.
It isn't. It's a matter of the heart. It's a matter of the fact that the strike was not at the Statue of Liberty. It was not at our churches. It was not at our schools. It was at the financial center of the world, at what the most rebellious Muslims refer to as New York, as the capital. Some of them call it Tel Aviv West.
Viola, I want to thank you very much for calling in. I'm going to go to Louisville, Kentucky. Jen's on the line. Jen?
Hi there.
Hi.
I'm a poet in Louisville, and I had been asked to read at a memorial on the 11th this year and found myself confronted by the same thing that many other callers have mentioned, which was a lack of a name for the thing, and none of the words were serving. And I finally found language served by an image from still photos of New Yorkers watching the event, and in every one of them that I've seen, there's someone with a hand clapped across their mouth. And this took me to a poem, and I'm going to share a little of it, if that's all right. We need a verb, not a noun, because it's not about the towers, see? It's not about the thing. We need a verb, not a noun, to frame the unspeakable. And no poem will serve, no word, noun, or verb. Picture this, then, Picture a crowd, blackened behind veil of ash, blacker than any burqa, wailing, and the rest of us silent, one hand restraining our mouths, one hand extended, pointing at what will never be named, beyond unspeakable.
The poet and the linguist, Sandy, to you.
It's interesting. I've been thinking about, by the way, quite a wonderful poem. I began life as a literature person, so I don't mean to imply that art isn't what we need to call on at such moments. But I'm interested that what we called vulnerability earlier in the show is in part characterized by our sense of not having words, that the need for words is so great because the world is once again created and recreated through language. In some sense, our anxiety speaks very much to the power of language in our lives.
One of the lines that I plucked from your book, Sandy, was a quote of President Roosevelt in his speech on the 9th of December, 1941, in which he says, "The true goal we seek is far above and beyond the ugly field of battle. When we resort to force, as now we must, we are determined that this force shall be directed toward ultimate good as well as against immediate evil. We Americans are not destroyers. We are builders." Jay, it's got a different sound.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I think of George Orwell's comment. He says, political language, and with variations, this is true of all political parties, from conservatives to anarchists, is designed to make lies sound truthful and murder respectable, and to give an appearance of solidity to pure wind. I mean, we talk, for example, we want a regime change in Iraq.
I left that one off my list of...
Yeah, well, what does that mean? We want to kill Saddam Hussein. Now, can the President of the United States say, we want to kill Saddam Hussein? That's what he means. And we don't say what we mean. And words of the kind that you've been talking about are a way of allowing us to wear a mask. I think that's very dangerous. And to come back to Jung, I think that the reason why it's dangerous is because the propensities that are in us are really violent.
Thanks for coming in. Jay Kaiser, Professor Emeritus of Linguistics at MIT. Sandy, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Dick.
Sandy Silberstein's a linguist at the University of Washington at Seattle, author of the new book War of Words, Language, Politics, and 9/11. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be.